We give you all the praise and all the glory. Amen. And so, the story is always the same. That morning, the ladies went to the tomb. They went to the tomb to take care of things that had not gotten taken care of at the time that Jesus was laid there. As they arrived to the tomb, the stone that was blocking the way was now rolled away, and there was some confusion as to what has happened. Jesus, he's not in there. In fact, they're told he's not there. They get distraught. They want to figure out, where is he? Where have you taken him? Mary is there. Mary is very distraught. She's crying so much that she doesn't realize that Jesus himself is standing there. She thinks he's the gardener. And she asks, where have you taken him? It's not until he says her name, Mary, that suddenly she realizes it's him. And she's given instructions. Go to the others. Go tell the others. Go tell Peter. And she runs. And she runs and she gets them. And as we saw in that video, they come running. They come running to the empty tomb. And so we have to ask this question this morning as we think about Easter. And what is it? How did we get here? How did we get to an empty tomb? Because see, the thing is, with a tomb, that must mean there's a death. There must have been a death. This past week has been what we call Holy Week. It begins with Palm Sunday, the triumphal entry. And as we progress from there to Friday, Good Friday, the day that man condemned God to die. And Jesus dies on that cross. Well, so how did we get there? How did we get to this death? Why did this death have to happen in the first place? See, for that, we actually have to go back even further. In fact, let's go back as far back as we possibly can. See, in the beginning, there was God. His Spirit hovered over this formless void of an earth. And in his wisdom, he decided, let's create. And so we have this moment where he has sea and he has land and he separates them. We have this moment where we see the sky and the sun and the moon, and eventually we get to this spot where there are plants and there are animals. And as if that wasn't enough, he says, wait, let's make man. And let's make him different. We'll make him in our image. In the image of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. We'll make him in the image of God. And so God handcrafts. He speaks everything to existence. He handcrafts man. And this is where the real beauty comes in. He breathes life into man. It is his very spirit that he breathes into man. Because we need to understand this morning that life is his. It's from him. It's not ours. So amongst this creation, then, there's this place. It's a garden. And this man that he's created, well, he's the gardener. And the gardener had one simple task, really. Take care of it all. I give it to you. Just take care of it. But this one tree over here, just don't touch this tree. This tree's not for you. Everything else is. That tree over there that keeps you alive, that's for you. This tree, not for you. The gardener didn't listen. The sin of the gardener was not obeying the instructions. With all the freedom, literally, in the world, he had one job, one thing. And one thing not to do. You see, it's that one thing. That's how we got here. Romans Romans 5 says this, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses. See, Moses, that's where the law comes in. So it's even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of one who was to come. Sin enters into the world through one man, Adam. And in this moment in Romans, Paul, the writer, he's pointing us towards something. He's saying, even though there's this great transgression of Adam, one thing, Adam's just a type of something. He's a picture of something that's to be changed, to come. There's one to come. See, this has been the problem, though, from near the beginning, hasn't it? It's sin. Sin is just not obeying God's instructions. One might say it's not obeying the law, but even here in Romans, we find out that sin was well before the law was ever established. So it's not disobeying the law. It's simply just disobeying God's instructions. The instructions is what? Don't touch. Sin is not obeying. Sin is not trusting that maybe God had a reason, don't touch. We walk through history, and what we do is we see a story. In fact, if you were to take your Bible there, we see this story, this particularly the story of God, the Bible. 66 books, right? But see, this is a story. This is a story. This is a story that begins in hope. It's a creation. It's a brand new beginning. There's nothing to say we've always done it that way. It's all new. So there's hope, but then within that hope then comes a fall. And with the fall then produces struggle. And then we just keep repeating it. There's a glimmer of hope. And then there's a fall. And then there's struggle. But ultimately it comes to a point of redemption. This morning, we're going to talk about what redemption looks like. See, redemption looks like, well, in that last verse, who is the type of the one who was to come? The redemption is something that is to come. See, this is a story. This is a story that I believe is connected from beginning to end. It's not 66 stories. It's not 66 books with 66 different stories happening in every single book. That's not what this is. This is one story with one plot. And we need to understand there is one main character that is consistent through the whole entire thing. And that one character is God. Understand that this is God's story. It's not our story. It's God's story. It's His story that He brings us into. Now, often we approach this story with the beginning. Every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. We love to approach the beginning, creation. And we like the end, Jesus. But sometimes we forget about the middle. And so this morning's sermon is not going to be your ordinary Easter service, because we're going to be taking a look at a story that comes out of the middle. But see, it's not just like we're just randomly pulling out a story in the middle, are we? No, it's still one story. It's a story that has the same beginning and it has the same end. See, there's a crazy thing about God. It's how He loves to tell His story, how He loves to connect the stories, and how He brings us into His story. And sometimes those stories, they're not even here. They're stories that are happening right around us. And so this morning, before we actually begin, I want you to hear a story. I'm going to ask Chad to go ahead and come forward. And this is Chad Stoltz. And Chad and I, we've known each other for a couple of years now. And there's been different areas where Chad's let me into his life. And I've gotten to know Chad. And we went to Australia together. We saw koala bears together. That bonds a person deeply. Amen. It's just a koala. Sorry, that's right. It's just a koala. inside Australia joke. But a couple of months ago, Chad shared a piece of his story, a piece that I was not aware of, a piece that I had not heard before. I thought I had heard all of Chad's story. I hadn't. Chad shared a piece of his story, and quite frankly, I listened to him share this story, and I was like, this is crazy, because see, I've been preparing for months now for Easter already up to this point. This is a couple months ago. And I said, this story so connects with where I feel God's taking me to Easter, that how can we go into it without others? I need others to hear Chad. And so I said, Chad, I need you to share your story with others. And Chad ran. No, he, you know what he said to me? And this may not sound amazing to you at this very split moment. It depends on how well you know Chad. He said, sure. He had to double check a few things, and you'll understand that in a moment. But he said, sure, because he understands that his story is God's story. He understands that his story is part of what God is doing. And so I'm not going to go any further than that. I'm just going to hand it over to Chad.
So I'm really happy to see that I recognize most everyone out here today. It's important for me for my story. Mike had asked me to do a testimony when I was finishing up the membership class, and it's my story, so it was no big deal. I wrote it out and went to class and I read it, and after I read it, I realized, wow, I mean, that's quite a story, and it affects so many people in my life that I've never shared it with. So for those of you who don't know me, you're about to know a lot of me, maybe more than you wanted to ever know about me. But it's been at least 20 years since I've been in a church like this and stood in front of people like this and feeling this vulnerable. And that was when I professed my commitment to love my wife in front of everyone. And now I'm honored and I'm blessed to be here today and be able to give this testimony about an even greater love. So this is my story. I was 9. My great-grandmother took me to church each Sunday. And she was the only person in my life who went to church. And she spent the majority of her life serving the Lord. And she insisted that my brother and I go every Sunday. She paid for my brother and I to go to church camp in the summers, and it was at the first church camp that first summer that my story of redemption begins. It was the last night of camp, and the last service was ending, and I was gathered together in a circle of about 10 kids and our counselor, and the emotions were running high, and we were being encouraged to be filled with the Holy Spirit as the pastor began speaking in tongues. And I was freaked out. I wasn't sure what was going on. And then suddenly some of the other kids started in. And I suddenly felt like if I didn't do something, my salvation was kaput. I was out. So I did what I had to do and I faked it. So my big question was I saved? And I mean, I wanted to be, and I felt like I had love for Jesus. And even before that night, I had prayed the prayer. So unfortunately, a couple weeks later, the high from the camp wears off, and I feel unsaved all over again. I was 17. And I needed to be baptized, and this is why. I had been attending a church off and on for a while on my own, but eventually I quit going. I fell completely off the grid, and I started a party. I finished my senior year in high school, and the summer that followed, immersed in alcohol and smoking pot. It was nearly a daily thing for me until one night, one of my buddies and I got ready to go out, And he tricked me into taking a hit of acid. And for those of you who don't know what it is, basically you take a little piece of paper that's been just ripped off of a much larger sheet of paper that's been dipped in the hallucinogenic drug. We were getting ready to go, and he was always the goofy one, and he looked at me and he said, "Close your eyes and stick out your tongue. I got a surprise for you." And all I felt him do was grab my tongue, and I thought, that's sick, you know. But the next 36 hours of insanity was the reason I called the pastor of my church that I attended, and I said, I need to be baptized now. I called my best friend, Brad, and he witnessed the baptism, and again, was I saved? And I wanted to be. And Brad wasn't a Christian at the time, and even though he wasn't nearly the partier I was, he was aware of my habits, and now he had a lot of questions for me. And so did I. I mean, I prayed the prayer. I was baptized. But at that time, my biggest concern for myself was starting over, and I was trying to set that certain point in time that I could use to start over from. I was 34, married to my wife of 13 years. Three young boys and a new exciting job. We bought our dream home. And I started working on the little farm that we'd always wanted, but I wasn't walking with the Lord. I progressively veered further and further off track until some of my bad decisions nearly cost me our marriage. We spent a week apart from each other, and I contemplated my life. Being apart from my family was beyond a doubt the most terrible thing I had ever experienced. And after some reconciliation and returning to normal life, I thought things would be better. But something was still missing. I was in over my head financially. There was tension between me and my wife, and I felt like I was failing as a father. I was spinning completely out of control, and it all came crashing down. It was at that moment when I got down on my knees in front of my wife for the second time, sobbing and confessing everything that I had failed at, and searching for her to redeem me. And in her beautiful wisdom, she wouldn't do it. She couldn't do it, and because she couldn't and wouldn't, the realization that the only one who had the power to do it was Jesus. I still thank God for giving her that wisdom and for her for applying it. I was a pitiful failure, and for the first time in my life, I had no fix for it. I turned to Jesus, and for the first time in my life, I prayed for redemption, real redemption. My revelation was, this is not about me. I suddenly realized how selfish I was, how every instance in my life that I had tried to get saved, it was about me trying to clean up my life so I felt saved. I realized my life belonged to God now, and I needed to give it over to Him. I finally admitted to myself that I was nothing, nothing without Jesus in my life, and I was humbled in the presence of God. I'm 41, and looking back now, I realize it was nearly immediate that I was filled with a desire to live a new life. I no longer wanted to do the things that I used to that separated me from God, and I craved His Word daily. I read or listened all the time, and I began sharing my love for it with my family. So this is my story of redemption, my beautiful, wonderful, amazing story of redemption. And just recently on Monday night with the men's group, we were reading 1 Samuel, and I couldn't help but see a little parallel. I'm not going to try and preach, but As I was preparing this testimony for this morning, my life before God was like the Israelites' desire for a king. It wasn't the plan for Israel to have a king, because God was already their king. But they wanted so bad to be like all the other nations, so it seemed as though God gave in and let them have their way. And they did get Saul as their king, just as I lived my life the way I wanted to live it. But God put into action his plan for Israel during that time, and ordained the small shepherd boy David, who slayed a giant and eventually became the king Israel really wanted in the first place. God had a plan in place for me that whole time, too, and it's still working its way out every day of my life, and I just finally realized the redemption I was seeking could only be found in the blood of Jesus. He is risen.
Thank you, Chad. Chad's going to change hats now. For those who perhaps have been with us for a couple of Easters now, you'll notice the paintings. Those are Chad's work, and he did those during the service, and he's going to be doing that again this morning. Open up to the book of Hosea. Do you know where Hosea is? Did you know we had a book called Hosea? For those who are not aware, if you open up to the book of Matthew and just go back a few books, you'll find yourself there. Matthew's usually pretty easy to find. We're going to be coming out of the story of Hosea this morning, an unlikely Easter story at best. First, I want to give you some history as to who this Hosea is and what exactly is going on. Hosea is one of 12 minor prophets. Now, I need you to understand something real quick here. When we say minor prophet, we're not talking about like he's a rookie, because we have major prophets and minor prophets. Somehow he hasn't hit the big time. Maybe one day he'll grow up to be a real prophet. That's not what a minor prophet is. No, the minor prophets, the 12 minor prophets, they had a very short-lived ministry. They had a very, very finite, specific point. Whereas the other ones, quite frankly, a major prophet, he had a major work. Minor prophets, still a major work, but done in a very minor amount of time, small books. In fact, Hosea is one of the two minor prophets that are the biggest of the minor prophet books. Most of them are just merely a few chapters. Now, we're not going to be going through all of Hosea. In fact, the bulk of Hosea are prophecies that are intended for Israel. What we'll be looking at is how Hosea is used to deliver those prophecies. So, understand that during the time of Hosea, the kingdom that we say Israel was actually divided into two parts. There was the northern part known as Israel, or in some cases also known as Ephraim. And then there was the southern kingdom known as Judah. The kingdom was divided. Now, Hosea in particular, he was sent to the northern kingdom. And this is unique. The vast majority of the prophets were all sent to Judah, the southern kingdom. But here, Hosea has been sent, he's been sent north. See, Israel, the northern kingdom, it was experiencing this time of great wealth and prosperity, so much so that they ultimately rely less and less and less on God. And as they do that, and as they allow the other kingdoms that are around them, such as Syria, as they intertwined with these things, the less reliance on God, what it ultimately did was it caused them to wander into worshiping other gods. I'm not going to mince words this morning. So I want you to understand, when we say worshiping other gods, we're not saying they went to a different church. We're not saying they sang different hymns. We're talking about going and sacrificing to these gods. Sacrifices that included sacrificing humans, their own children. We're talking about worship in things of not just pure idolatry, but of sexual immorality. Temples filled with prostitutes. We're going to see that this morning. And as Hosea is called to speak to the nation of Israel, he is called to a message that ultimately has already been proclaimed and promised by Moses. See, Moses prophesied that Israel would enter into the promised land, a whole kingdom, and no sooner that they get there, they will break their covenant with the God that brought them there. And ultimately, this will cause them to go back into an exile. Remember, it's Moses who goes in and redeems them out of Egypt. This ultimately is the plight of Israel, forgetting the God that called them out to be separate, to be holy, to be His. And so we begin in Hosea chapter 12, 8, just for a moment here. Listen to these words. Ephraim, that's Israel, northern kingdom, has said, "Ah, but I am rich. I have found wealth for myself in all my labors. They cannot find in me iniquity or sin." This is what the northern kingdom has become. These are very condemning words of self-made men. "You can't fault me. Look at all the stuff I have. How great am I that I have this? Surely I have done well because I've amassed all of this. I've amassed this kingdom." Ephraim, Israel, the northern kingdom has become a kingdom unto itself, a kingdom without a need for God. And so Hosea's mission is not just to remind Israel who truly is their maker and their king, but it's to reveal to them what they've become. And that once again, they are in need of rescue. They are in need of redemption. Once again, just like out of Egypt. And it's interesting that if you go through the course of Hosea, just a handful of chapters really, over 100 times, God prophesies judgment by saying, "I will." It's not "I may," but "I will." There is a coming judgment that is coming down. God's using Hosea to declare this message. There are moments in my life, perhaps in yours as well, where you go through something. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not so good. And we have to stop and we laugh for a moment. We realize, that's something I can learn from, right? That's a learning moment. Maybe we call those moments teachable moments, where we realize that God has taught us something through whatever it is that we just went through. This usually comes at the expense of pride and humility, doesn't it? And I have found that once I had kids, these moments come far more frequently now. When it comes to the prophets, God often calls them to do strange things. Prophets are strange ducks. That's all there is to it. They are weird guys with unique sets of talents to do amazingly bizarre things, ultimately creating teachable moments. Now, in some cases, it could be an understandable request that God might have for the prophets. But every now and then, it's just really odd. I have to say, it's a bit like, can I go all Karate Kid for a moment? It's wax on, wax off. It's Mr. Miyagi asking all of these bizarre little things, and it's like, what are you doing? And he didn't realize he was learning something all along. It's much like watching a painter. Oh, you don't always see what's coming. You can try to anticipate it. You might actually even know what's being painted. But even after it's all said and done, there's a certain beauty that will just pop out at you that you didn't know was there. See, Hosea, this is one of those moments. And I have to say, as we go into this, I hope you wrestle with it the way that I think Hosea may have had to have wrestled with it. So we begin, Hosea 1, verse 1. "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel." So far, so good. We get out of the gate, we know, okay, Hosea is our main character in this moment. All right, we've got that. We understand the time period he's in because if we take our little history lesson and learn about the kings and everything, we kind of get this idea of when and where and all this is happening. So far, so good. Nothing too strange about this. The word of the Lord's coming to Hosea. Hosea, you're going to go do something for me. You're going to go proclaim a message. Here we go. Then the Lord first spoke through Hosea. The Lord said to Hosea, go, take yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. What? Go and marry a what? Go and marry a whore? Did we just read in one verse the word whoredom three times? Has Pastor Mike just said the word whore six times in less than 1 minute in church? What is going on? I don't get it. Okay, Jose, I want you to go talk to Israel. You're going to bring Israel back to home, and you're going to do this by going and getting a whore. Let's not mince words here. This is not a euphemism. This is not some kind of innuendo here. This is a whore. This is a prostitute, one who is unfaithful, one who is sleeping with somebody that's not their spouse and most likely for money. Did God just tell Hosea to marry a whore? Is this the beginning of Pretty Woman? Is that what's happening here? No. But did he ask him to go do it? Yeah, it gives whole new meaning to Isaiah 55:8. It says, your ways are not my ways, Lord. Your thoughts, they're not my thoughts. No kidding. So where does one go find such a woman? Well, see, most likely she was one of many in the temples of the false gods, the prostitutes of the false gods. See, when we talk about that worshiping false gods, that was part of it. Sexual orgies happening day and night. The temples were whorehouses. And to worship, you would go and you would pay and you would do that. This is one of those moments that just, let's face it, it doesn't really make sense. But it will. Because see, there's more to the story than what we know. Now, it's obvious that right away, the picture here, because it says right there, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. We have this picture that's being given to us, a picture of Israel, the northern kingdom, a nation that commits great whoredom, meaning that they are worshiping other gods. This nation is meant to be his and his alone, and instead they're sleeping around literally with other nations, with other gods. They're giving themselves in intimate ways. We know that our God is a jealous God. This is why he's a jealous God. See, this language that's actually being spoken here, this is covenant language. This is marriage language. See, the picture is that Israel is to be married to God. Covenant relationship, that this is a vow, not to be confused with an oath. See, an oath, Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. That's a promise that we might make to one another. But a vow is supposed to be permanent. It is supposed to be obeyed. It is supposed to be trusted. It is not to be broken. Israel, the northern kingdom, God's chosen people, they continue to break that covenant. If you spend any time in the book of Deuteronomy, you'll see that Moses speaks to this numerous times. So to show Israel that they have broken the covenant, God ultimately compares it to breaking a marriage vow. This is how serious God takes this. Because, see, Israel is dishonoring the marriage bed. They're allowing somebody else into it. But rather than just saying it, because after all he has said it numerous times through Moses, not just saying it, he takes his servant, he takes his man Hosea, and he demonstrates it to them. And it's interesting that God going to demonstrate this in action. This is the same God that rescued the people out of Egypt. These ancestors, they witnessed the plagues, the Passover. They walked on dry land as literally as the water was being held up to their sides. These are the stories that they would know of this God. And after all of those things, they've turned their back on him. But we need to understand that God hasn't turned his back. Not yet. So is God so desperate to get their attention that he inflicts this highly demoralizing event on Hosea? Is that what he's doing? Or is there a bigger picture to be seen? We need to let the story unfold. So out of this unconventional marriage, we get a son. This is a good thing, right? This is a good news. I mean, for a wife to bear a son, that's an honorable thing. There's nothing greater during this particular time period but to say, you've given me a son, somebody to carry on my namesake. And so we have this picture of a son. This is a grand thing. This is a good thing, right? Verse 4 says, and the Lord said to him, call him Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. He's given this name as a reminder of the past transgressions of the kings, and that now Israel will be held to an account, that there is judgment coming down now on this whole culture of whoredom that Israel has become. And it says that he will break the bow. That is the sign of defeat. You take your enemy's weapon and you break it. They have nothing to fight you with anymore. They are completely broken. This is powerful imagery that, and it's just beginning. We have a wife that has been called, he has been called to receive out of prostitution, and she bears Hosea's son. Now, last I checked, that takes about 9 months to happen. So we're not looking at some quick little message where he just gets in, says his message, and gets out. This is something that's going to take some time. In fact, we move on. Verse 6, she conceived again and bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah. That's the other kingdom. I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. And when she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, call his name Not My People, for you are not my people and I am not your God. She has two more kids. Now, I have an affinity for unique names. Those of you know my children, you know their names, and you think, well, yeah, but Mick, that's not unique. It's his middle name. That's where his kicker comes in. I love unique names, and I'm always asked, is there a significance behind their names in a spiritual sense? And I always laugh because there's not. No Mercy. Beautiful name for a girl. I can't think of a girl more pretty than No Mercy. And then let's have another son, and we'll call him Not My People. This is not the only time that the Lord or those in the Bible give these unique names, but I got to say, that seems awfully harsh. That kind of puts a little stigma on you. How'd you get that name, No Mercy? How'd you get that name, Not My People? Why would God have Hosea have two more kids and give them these names? Wait. He didn't. I want to show you something that we might miss, because again, there's a bigger picture. Verse 3 says this, and it's a very important one little word difference. Verse 3 says, she bore him, that's Hosea, she bore him a son. Verse 6, she conceived again and bore a daughter. Verse 8, and when she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. They're not Hosea's. These are not Hosea's kids. It would have said, bore him a daughter, bore him a son. It doesn't. It just says that this woman, Gomer, she's had two more kids. They're illegitimate as far as Hosea goes. What does that say about Gomer at this moment? She returned to a life of whoredom. Consider the dark reality of verse 8. When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. No sooner than she was done with this child, she went and had another one, just tossing it off to the side and going again. Israel had been rescued, redeemed out of Egypt. Gomer had been rescued, redeemed, given a new life, an honorable life, a life of a man of God. And she returned to her old life. Israel's been rescued, redeemed out of Egypt, and they return over and over and over, and God's had enough. And so we finish out chapter 1. It says, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand in the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. There's a promise there. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together. Two kingdoms, they'll be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head, and they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. This is covenant language again. This is the promise made to Abraham. A promise of a bountiful nation. One that would ultimately bless other nations. That one that those who bless them will be blessed, but those who curse them will be cursed. And so I have to ask the question, what happens when the blessing nation actually becomes the cursing nation? What happens to that nation? Hosea had one mission, to speak to Israel that they might know God. And he would end up taking a whore for a wife, perhaps never fully grasping what the painting that was being painted was all along, to understand, to prophesy that there shall be one head. Hosea, maybe he's thinking, okay, I got Israel and we got Judah. We have a divided kingdom. It will be a reunited kingdom. Hosea is thinking perhaps his work, this whole entire endeavor, marrying this whore, having one legitimate son, but then having two not legitimate, and having them there, that this would bring the kingdom together, that they would have one king. It would be just like the good old days. It'd be like the days of David. We talked about that last week. Hosea perhaps would never have thought that these words spoken in the northern kingdom, this half of a divided kingdom, that he was actually speaking of another kingdom altogether. John records in his Gospels this meeting of Jesus with a woman at a well. And as he comes to this well, and he tells her he's thirsty. So she draws him some water. He then goes on to tell her, you know, this water, I have water that if you drink, you'll never thirst. I have living water. See, he's at the well of Jacob, and understand, he's saying, I have water better than this well. This is the well of all wells, okay? And he's saying, I have water that's living water, water that's better than this. And she's amazed at this, and she says, I should tell my husband. And he says, oh, yeah, you should. Which one? See, she had many husbands. Five. In fact, the guy she was with right now, not even hers. So all by definition, she's living a life of whoredom. Now, she's pretty shocked that Jesus knows this all about her, and how is it possible? So he must be a prophet. It's interesting, she's waiting for a prophet. And so she takes the opportunity, as you might if you're in front of a prophet. Let me ask you a theological question. Some say that the true worship happens here. Others say that the true worship is happening in Jerusalem. See, she's talking about a divided kingdom. Even though it's technically not divided anymore, it's still being treated that way. People are still acting. So who's right, us or them? It's at that moment that Jesus reveals that there's a greater kingdom at hand. He reveals that ultimately he is the greater kingdom, that he is the greater ruler of one land, one head. See, this event, this woman at the well, it all takes place in Samaria. Do you know that Samaria is the capital of the northern kingdom? Is it any coincidence that Jesus has this conversation with a woman of ill repute, whoredom, in Samaria, the northern kingdom? Is Jesus taking this story and connecting it to Hosea? Absolutely. We get into Hosea chapter 2. Not going to read it all. But this is the first prophecy that's given to Hosea to give to the people. And just listen for a moment to the very first verse. Say to your brothers, you are my people. And to your sisters, you have received mercy. Wait a minute. We just got done naming two kids what? Not Mercy, the girl. Not My People, the boy. But there's coming this moment where they will be the people. They will be receiving mercy. We get to the end of this prophecy. And we get down to verses 21. And it says, "In that day I will answer, declares the Lord. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. And the earth shall answer the grain and the wine and the oil." All those things will make sense in a moment. And they shall answer Jezreel, "And I will sow for her myself in the land. And I will have mercy on no mercy. And I will say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God." There is a different kingdom at hand. There is a different coming together at hand here in Hosea that's being birthed out of something so confusing, so ugly. Hosea 3, very short chapter, it says, "And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lecheth of barley. And I have said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you." Hosea is instructed, go get your wife. She's returned back to that life, and he's saying, go get your wife back. In fact, Hosea goes and he pays for her again. He pays for her a second time, and you cannot miss this. One of the items that he pays for her, it's a homer. Come on, that's a homer for Gomer. That's a moment there. He says that he bought her for 15 shekels of silver, a homer. We're talking about money. We're talking about grain. We're talking about oil. All those things that we just got done seeing in that prophecy. He goes and buys her for a second time. But you know what's interesting about the amount that he pays for her? It's about half of what you pay for a slave. Half. He got her for half price. He's buying her a second time. He got her 50% off. You know why? Because as far as the world that she had gone back to, that's what they valued her at. She had lost her value. She's used goods. Israel is being painted as this picture. These people are being painted as a picture as worthless. Because the kingdom had embraced others, and in so losing themselves. It talks about cakes of raisins. This is really an odd little phrase. It doesn't pop up anywhere else. What's a cake of raisin? There's a lot of speculation over this one. In the end, it's most likely it's a cake that, it contains a few extra items in it. It's probably a cake that's filled with alcohol. In fact, the raisins is a reference to wine. So this is a raisin cake. This is I know most traditionally raisin cakes are raisin rum cakes. This is probably made with the scraps, the leftovers of the wine press. It also, I think, explains fruitcake. You wonder, where does that evil brick of bread come from? I don't know about you. I don't know anybody who eats it, but I think there are bricks of fruitcake that date back to this period of time that are still in existence, being passed family to family. No, what this is just saying, you know what? You eat the cakes of other gods. You worship at other gods. You let them feed you. And what Hosea is telling this wife as he goes and he gets her again, you must dwell as mine. I'm purchasing you. I'm pulling you out of there. You're not going to play the whore anymore. You don't belong to others. You belong to me. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without a king or a prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterwards, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. David's come and gone. We're talking about a new David. David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. We have this language of this redemption. All I can think of is 1 Peter. But you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his what? His own possession. That you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness, who called you out of the prostitute's temple. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Does that sound familiar to you? Once you were not a people, you were him. Once you were no mercy, you were her. But no longer, because you're his. You're his possession. 1 Corinthians 6:20 and 7:23 both say that we were bought with a price. 7:23 in particular, it's comparing to serving another man. You can't serve another man because you were bought by this man. You were bought by this master. So you can't serve him. You have to serve the one that bought you. But when we look at the context of 1 Corinthians 6:20, going in the middle there, verse 13, it says, the body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Verse 15, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Flee from the prostitute temple. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own. For you were bought with a price. So glorify God. You were bought with a price. It's wedding language all over again. It's the dowry, right? The dowry is this, that a young man comes to a man and says, I want to marry your daughter, sir. Here's a cow. I mean, it's a fair trade, right? And he says, no, here, take this cow. No, what is he saying? He's saying this is a down payment to the value, the worth of your daughter. Now, understand, a cow, that's a big value. But this is just the first payment. And then he comes with the true gift of exchange. The question would be, what is the value of this daughter to the father that he might let it go, let her go? What is the value of this young man in terms of this? What will he be willing to sacrifice? So it starts out, here's a cow. And then it's, here's a cow and a goat. If somebody wants to come for my daughters, here are season tickets to the Cubs. I mean, there must be a significant value to what's being given. The groom would then go and prepare a place for his bride. He would prepare a place for his bride, a possession of great worth, not like property, but like the prized jewel of a crown. One that needs protected. One of beauty and opulence. See, this morning I began asking and talking about how did we get here? How did we get to Easter? And looking at Romans 5, we see that we get here because of Adam. Sin enters the world. And because of that, we need to be redeemed of that. If we go to Hosea 6, again, lots of different prophecy that is happening here, but it just starts off with this. Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down and he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us, and on the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. On the third day, he will raise. Does that sound familiar? That's resurrection. That's Easter. That's what's happening here. Let us know. Let us press on to know the Lord. Verse 4. What shall I do with, O Ephraim? What shall I do with that northern kingdom? What shall I do with, O Judah, the southern kingdom? O you boys, what will I do with you? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early. It says, therefore, I've hewn them by the prophets. I've slain them by my words. The judgment goes forth. He says all these things. For I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice. Stop giving me your gifts. Give me you. That's what I want. I want you. This is God speaking. He's speaking to Israel. He's speaking to you this morning. Don't just give me your gifts. Don't give me your time. Give me you. Verse 7, but like Adam, they transgressed the covenant. There they dealt faithlessly with me. Verse 11, for you also, O Judah, a harvest is appointed. There's a time coming. There's a promise approaching. Understand that the words that Hosea is sharing there, well, Hosea becomes a picture. He becomes a picture of Jesus. He's a type of Jesus. Romans 5 tells us that there's a type of one to come. Hosea is this type, is this picture of Jesus. By the way, did you know Hosea? Hosea means, since we have names with meanings, Hosea means salvation. As Jesus entered into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry, we talked about it last week, the crowd cries out, Hosanna, which is to say, save us. So, my question this morning, if Hosea ultimately represents Jesus, who's Gomer? In the immediate story, it's Israel. In the story today, for us today, it's us. We're Gomer. I don't want to be Gomer. I don't want that, but that's who I am. Sin entered in by one man, and ultimately salvation by one man. Adam is a type of Jesus. He's a gardener. There's a picture that's being connected from beginning to end. If we go into Romans 5, we'll read even further, even deeper into this, that while we were weak, at our weakest moment, in that moment that we've drudged ourselves back to the sin that we came from, it's in that moment that Jesus comes and dies. He didn't come to die for a righteous person. He died for us while we were what? He came for us while we were what? Still sinners. While we were in the temple with the prostitutes. That's when he came. And now here's Jesus come for his bride. Hosea, go get your wife. Jesus has come for his bride. How did we get here? Because Christ came in the first place. See, we were created in his image. And we went against his instructions. That's sin. Sin has its effect. It's death. Jesus came that we might be redeemed, bought over and over and over again, bought once at the cross. He bought us even in our sin, even though we served another master, even though we went to bed with someone who's not ours, he still redeemed us. He redeemed us as Hosea redeemed Gomer. As the groom comes for his bride, in Matthew, Jesus shares this parable of 10 virgins, and it says that there's these 10 virgins, 5 of them foolishly don't prepare for their groom to come. The other 5, they do prepare. And when the time comes that the wedding party arrives, 5 are left behind. Why are they left behind? Because they were too busy playing around. They weren't prepared. They weren't ready. This is a parable about virgins, not whores, pure girls. And yet even 5 of them were left. What hope is there for a Gomer? There's an incredible hope. And there will come a moment. There will come a moment when the groom comes for his bride a final time. And there's no room for folly. And there's no time to play the field anymore. We go to Revelation 21, and it says that, behold, I see a new heaven and a new earth. The old has passed away. There's a finality. And he says in that moment that Jerusalem will come down as a bride adorned for, and all I can think of is when I got married. And for those who've been in that process, I don't know about you, but I know that on that day I wept because I saw my bride come. I knew what that meant. I knew that there was a commitment that was going to happen here that should not be broken, that should be cherished like a precious jewel on a crown. And this is how God sees you. He does not see you as the whore in the temple. He sees you as the gem on the, that is his love for you, that he sees past all of those things. I began with how we got here in general, but I'm asking you this morning, where are you now? Are you still playing around in that temple, or are you ready to be his bride? I'm going to ask the worship team to go ahead and come forward, and we're going to go into a time of communion. And all around here, there are the elements of the communion. There's the bread and there's the cup. And communion was instituted by Jesus at the last meal he has with his disciples before going to the cross. This was during the time of Passover. Jesus at that table, he took a piece of the bread that was there. This bread would have deep meaning in that Passover meal, because this bread represented the provision that God gave to his people while in the wilderness. And so he took that bread and he ultimately declared, he says, this is me. Okay, this is me. I am the provision. I am the ultimate provision. This is me. In fact, he goes further. He says, this is my body. And he takes the bread and he breaks the bread and he says, this is my body broken for you. I'm paying the price. You're not paying the price. You can't get out of the temple by yourself. I've come. I have paid the dowry. I have paid the price. I've paid money to masters that you should never have belonged to in the first place. Sin, death, I paid the price. And then at the same time, he took the cup. And as he took this cup, this cup would be one of many cups that are there at the Passover meal. Specifically, he would take the third cup. The third cup was known as the cup of blessing, the cup of redemption, a cup of things to come at the Passover meal. The cup of one to come. This cup would be the exact same cup, literally the same cup. It'd be a traditional cup in the family. This very same cup would be used in the family traditions of marriage. It would be used both before and during wedding ceremony. It was a cup of blessing, a cup of redemption. It was a cup of commitment. It was a cup of covenant. This cup would always be filled at the proper time and not before. At the proper time, it would be filled with the best wine. Just the way Jesus did it at his first miracle at a wedding. Jesus declares that wine his blood, that he is the blessing inside the cup, that he is the blood of the Passover lamb. He is the one to come. He is the redemption. He is the price to be paid. And for us to drink from it means that we enter into this new covenant, a new covenant that is the fulfillment of all covenants. This new covenant would bring us to a new exodus out of a very old Egypt. It would be a new redemption, which means a new king, and we become a new people. We become his bride. Paul tells us to examine our hearts before we come to the table. And this morning, you're invited to come to the table. Again, if you haven't been here before, we have the elements there. You simply take a piece of the bread. You dip it in the cup. This is communion, taking it together. But Paul says we need to examine our hearts. And I've got to warn you at this moment. Be careful of the steps that you take. Because see, Paul says that if we don't examine our hearts, we make a mockery of it. This is just a story and these are just elements and they have no significance. They mean nothing. He's addressing this to a church. He's addressing to a church that is divided. And he wants us to understand that communion is for the united. That's who the table's for. It's not for the perfect. Don't think that you have to find a way to be perfect and then present yourself before God. God does not ask you to perfect yourself. You can't. You will always be found in the temple. He declares us righteous. He declares us holy. Do you understand that? That God declares you are a holy nation, a people belonging to him. This is what we've read this morning. This is what we've seen. And no matter how far down the path of Gomer we think we might have gone, no matter how far away from redemption we think we've gotten, understand that the bread and the cup says no. The bread says no, you come. It says you come to me because I've called you. I declare you righteous. I call you holy. I call you mine. The table is for one who knows the cost that went into having the table. How did we get here? Why are we here? It's this table. It's to know him. And again, otherwise, it's just a cup. It's just bread. It's just a symbol. Hosea, just a really weird story. I come to the table, me personally. I come to the table and I recognize something. Something that you don't want to recognize. I come to the table and I have to say, Lord, I'm not worthy. Lord, I'm a whore. I'm a sinner. And do you know what God says in that moment? No, you're not. You're mine. Do you understand what it means to be mine? You're not these things. Who told you these things? Back in the garden, Adam and Eve were hiding. And when God comes to find them, they're filled with shame. And when he finds them, they discover they're naked. They've been naked all this time, but now suddenly it matters. And they're hiding, and when God finds them, he says, why are you hiding? And they says, well, we were ashamed, and because we're naked. And you know what God's response to that is? Who told you that? I didn't tell you that. You're exactly what you're supposed to be. Why'd you touch the tree? Why'd you have to go there? God calls us to the table, and we're that naked whore. You read Hosea 2. We're that naked, torn, half-priced whore. And God says, no, you're not. You are more precious than anything on this planet. This is what you are worth to God. His son. The dowry, it's not a goat. It's not a cow. It's not cows of thousands of heads on a hill. That's all worthless. It's his son. As you approach the communion table this morning, that I've asked the worship team to do a particular song. And sorry, Russ, I'm in your picture there. I haven't got a chance to look yet. I've asked them to do a particular song. And maybe you know the song, and if you do, please sing. But more than anything, respond to the words. Respond to the words and respond to it in communion, in holy communion, in the separate, set-apart moment that's between you and your God, because you are not a people. You are his people, if you know him. This morning, do not leave this place not his people. Don't leave this place with no mercy. Understand you, it's all here. It's his grace, and he's... He's paying the price. He paid the price. And the price, the cost, God found it sufficient.